Welcome today to our Minnesota House of Representatives Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. I'm Connie Bernardi, and pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting to order. The CLA will take the roll to determine which members are present.
Mr. Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill.
Present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Albright. Representative Albright. Representative Daniels.
Present.
Daniels, present. Representative Erickson.
Present.
Erickson, present. Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen. Representative Heintzman.
Representative Heintzman, present.
Heintzman, present. Representative Howard.
Present.
Howard, present. Representative Keeler.
Keeler, present.
Keeler, present. Representative Cleavorne.
Cleavorne, present.
Cleavorne, present. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Crenshaw. Representative Mason.
Mason, present.
Representative Meckland. Representative Knorr.
Present.
Knorr, present. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Representative Sandsted.
Present.
Sandsted, present. Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson. Representative Albright. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Hansen, present. And a quorum is present.
Thank you. And may I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 10th, 2021?
Chair.
Okay. I see Vice Chair Christensen moves the approval of the minutes for February 10th, 2021. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Thompson's present. I'm having
okay. Thank you. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 10th, 2021 are approved. And I see we have Representative Thompson here has joined. Welcome. Today we have a presentation from Minnesota State who will give an overview of their budget and their budget allocation process. I know we have a lot of new and returning members on the committee. We want to give everyone a chance to learn more about how the system budget operates. We will pause to take questions from members at the end of each section of the presentation. We have two presenters with us today, starting with Vice Chancellor Bill Mackey. And then we will also have Lori Clues, Vice President of Administration from St. Cloud Technical and Community College. Mr. Mackey, welcome to our committee. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Members, it's a pleasure for us to be here this afternoon to discuss the budget allocation process for Minnesota State. Again, for the record, I am Bill Mackey, Vice Chancellor for Finance and Facilities. I've been in my position for about a year and a half. Previous to that, I was president of the Northeast Higher Education District for 4 years, and was, and prior to that, was vice president for finance and administration at Bemidji State University and Northwest Technical College. This afternoon, with me, my colleague testifying with me today, Lori Clues, has served St. Cloud Technical and Community College as a Vice President of Administration and their Chief Financial Officer since 2000, and also served as Interim President in 2017 and 2018 and as Acting President in 2025. And we wanted to share with you not only a system perspective of the budgeting process, but also a campus perspective. So Lori will add that insight into this process. Our overview of today's discussions is we're going to, I'll provide some information on overview of system revenue and expenses, the relationship between our state appropriation and our tuition, and our system allocation methodology before turning it over to Vice President Kloos, who will discuss further the system allocation methodology and how it's incorporated into overall college budgeting and planning. To start with, for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, this information from our fiscal year 20 audited financial statements, which were released in November, this is a breakdown of our just over $2 billion in annual revenue. As you can see, Minnesota State is most reliant on state appropriation and tuition, making up the 38% of state appropriation and 26% of tuition, making up 64% of the overall revenue that comes into the system. We also have 15% of our revenue is financial aid that flows to our students after their tuition and other fees are paid. We have some other revenues, which includes our federal, state, private grants activity, auxiliary revenues, such as our some of our bookstores, income from some public facing activities, such as some of our technical programs that provide services, such as dental hygienist programs, automotive repair and carpentry, to name a few, and also have some activity related to our revenue fund, 4%, the gray box on the right, just over $90 million. That's made up primarily of our residence halls at our state, or at our six of our state universities, student unions at some of our campuses, campus wellness centers, and some of our parking structures and lots. And then we have a portion, 3%, that's fees. So again, our primary revenue sources are clearly our state appropriation and tuition that comes to our colleges and universities. Shifting to the expense side, and accordingly, we have just over $2 billion in expenses system-wide. Close to 70% of our expenses are spent on salaries and benefits, just over $1.4 billion. For purposes of this presentation, we've excluded pension and post-employment benefit liabilities that are included in our financial statements that are a flow through for defined benefit plans coming through the state and TRA. We usually take that information out because it varies significantly from year to year in order to show clear comparisons from year to year. Our other expenditures, the other 30% or so that is non-personnel expense, we have purchased services for 11%, supplies for 6%, and then the other includes categories such as equipment and travel, and that makes up 14%. But as you can see from our operating expenses, we're heavily a people-driven organization, and compensation is our majority expense. Another way that we commonly show our expenses is by functional area. And this is done with the IPEDS reporting standard, which stands for Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data Source. And this is a way that we categorize our data, and it allows us to show how much we spend per functional area, and also allows us the opportunity to benchmark our system as well as individual colleges and universities being able to benchmark themselves with peers across the country. And as you can see from this illustration of expenses, instruction is 43%, the gray almost half circle on the bottom. Student services is 15%, the green portion of the pie chart, and academic support is 13%. So we have, just in those three categories, 71% of our expenses are spent on directly providing instruction or services to our students. And this is consistent with the mission of Minnesota State and our colleges and universities. You'll notice, you know, in comparison, the amount of money that is spent on research and public service adds up to less than 2% of our overall expenses. We have, again, that auxiliary enterprise activity that I refer to, some of our bookstores, food service, those types of some of those amenities that we provide to our students, and then 5% on scholarships. But 71% of our expenses to instruction, student services, and academic support, which are providing direct services to our student. We also have the 13% of institutional support, which is some of our fixed costs and administrative overhead that is at the system level and at the campus level. That is a brief overview of our expenses and revenues, and I would pause for a moment to see if there's any questions before moving to the next section of the presentation.
Thank you. We have Representative Keeler has a question. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually do have a question. Where in all of these, I know we talked about salary being 69%, but is that including your student employees? And then also, like, if you have grad assistants working in classrooms in exchange for credit, is that an in-kind? Where is that in all of these pie charts? Because I know that that's a big part of the system.
Mr. Mackey.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Keeler. That information, so within the operating expenses for salaries and benefits, any salaries or wages paid to our students are included within that 69%. Within the functional categories, the graduate assistants would be included either under instruction or research in most cases. Our graduate assistants at our universities typically receive an annual stipend and receive also a tuition waiver to cover part of their graduate credits. So both of those expenses are reflected in our data. Other student workers are reflected in the data here based on what department they work in. So for example, a student that works in perhaps as a tour guide and works in the admissions office would be included in our student services functional area, whereas a student worker who helps with custodial duties may be under institutional support, where tutors might be under academic support, but they all, it is all accounted for in our data.
Representative Keeler.
Yep, so that's really helpful for me. I would kind of like to see, and it can be a conversation offline, especially in the salaries of that 69%, what percent of that is paying out students, because I think it's really important to understand that our students are playing a really valuable role in the greater work that our universities are doing. And so when we make schools so unaffordable, they're also the employees that are making all of this magic happen, I guess. And so maybe we can meet offline a little bit more to talk more about the numbers and the impact that our students are having as from an employee lens. Thank you.
Members, are there any other questions before Mr. Mackey proceeds? Seeing no hands up, Mr. Mackey, would you like to continue?
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. I'm going to shift now to talk about Minnesota State's tuition and appropriation. As I mentioned, those being our two primary sources of revenue, we focus a lot of attention on managing those two primary resources. Our recent history of tuition rate changes, and this is our undergraduate tuition, is that over the last 8 years, as you can see by this chart, we've been in a position where our colleges and our universities have differed slightly by sector. So for our 30 colleges on the left side of the chart, 2014 through 2019 were basically tuition was frozen for undergraduate students. You'll see in 2017, it was reduced 1%, but then it was increased 1% the following year. So the net effect over the course of that period is it ended up being at the same rate as 2016 at the end of 2018. For our universities, the story has been a little bit different during that 6 year time period. Our university tuition rates generally within the regional and national higher education landscape are not at the same level in comparing them to other institutions. So there was the ability for universities to, at the beginning of two bienniums, raise tuition around the rate of inflation, slightly higher, at 3.4% in 2016 and 3.9% in 2018, and then it was frozen the second year of the biennium. For 2020 and 2021, the system came in with a very aggressive biennial budget request, and part of that funding request was to freeze tuition in lieu of a 3% tuition increase. When the budget was passed and we moved into the 2020-2021 biennium, no funding to support a tuition freeze, but there was permission to consider increasing tuition by 3%. So the last 2 years, our base tuition increase for undergraduates at our colleges and universities have increased by 3% each year. For this year, for fiscal year 21, for fall 2020, our Board of Trustees made a decision to reallocate state appropriation to freeze tuition for fall 2020 and not implement the increase until spring semester 2021. So that is what the asterisk is for, is that we had one semester this year of tuition at our 2019-2020 rates, and then the tuition increase was implemented at the start of spring semester 2021. So over this time period, we've had relatively either frozen rates or have had tuition increases in the range of 3%. I would also note related to this is that in 2017 and in 2019, when tuition was frozen, campuses reallocated funds in order to cover base expenses. We were fortunate as a system to receive state appropriation funding to cover the tuition freezes in 14, 15, and 16, but the tuition freezes in cut in 17 and the freeze in 19, there was not state appropriation to backfill that tuition increase. So the institutions had to make reallocations or budget reductions in some cases in order to cover their ongoing costs during that time period. The next slide brings together our relationship between state appropriation and tuition over about a 20-year time period. And we go back to fiscal year 2002. Our state appropriation compared to our tuition was about a two-thirds, one-third split. And then during the recession in the mid to late 2000s, that ratio became about 50% appropriation and 50% tuition. in 2013, the amount spiked at 60% tuition and 40% appropriation. And that was a combination of several different factors at the time. One of them was that our enrollment was growing and peaked in 2011. So we had more students paying tuition. We also, because again, we were in a recession period, we did have some state appropriation reductions during that time period. Since that 2013 60-40 split tuition appropriation, it's now about 50-50 again, depending on the year. We've been fortunate the past several years to receive additional state funding that has helped move that 40% up to 50%. And also related to that, as we've also seen an enrollment decline during that time period. So along with freezing tuition, we've also had less students paying tuition. So that rate is, or that ratio is now at about 50-50. During the 2021 biennium, the 2021 is still an estimate, but we're, based on our current enrollment projections, we're thinking we're going to end the year at approximately 52% appropriation and 48% tuition. What I just shared with you was at the system level, the 50% appropriation, 50% tuition. But it's really important for me to note that we have variety across the system between our 30 colleges and our 7 universities on how much their budget is funded by appropriation and how much is funded by tuition. And what I have in front of you, this busy chart, is our 37 institutions using fiscal year 19 data showing each institution. And you'll see on the far left, Minnesota State University Mankato, their budget, 36% of it is appropriation and 64% of it is tuition. And if we go to the far right side of the graph, Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College has 68% reliance on appropriation and 32% on tuition. The variance of why this is different from each of the institutions has to do a lot based on the mission of the specific institution, as well as history that goes back to pre-merger when the three systems were merged together. Generally speaking, for us, our state universities tend to rely more on tuition revenue than our appropriations compared to our colleges. So on the left side of the chart, you'll notice that there's three universities, and then there's two of our large two-year colleges, and then another university. Where on the right side of the chart tends to be our colleges that had a heavy history as being a standalone technical college in the previous system, and were more reliant on state appropriation. So as we think about this within Minnesota State, we know that decisions that are made related to tuition policy or how enrollment losses or gains impact institutions, is that there really is 30 different stories for our colleges and 7 different stories for our universities. And I think that's important to note, because oftentimes we're just talking at a very high macro level versus providing an information that within a community, there might be a very different story for that institution depending on the economic circumstances of their individual college or university. And I'm gonna pause now with this section and see if there's any questions related to our state appropriation tuition relationship.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mackey, I wanna draw your attention to your slide 6 and slide 7. And forgive me, I think you made a reference to that the amounts or percentages of increase fairly followed inflation, but I I did a little checking, and I think the rate of inflation during that same period of time was 1.6%. So I think you're a little high on the mark. But you might have your own figures there, but that's coming from MMB. So just use it for food for thought. You also made a point of saying, and this is where maybe a little clarification comes into play, but you said that, you know, fewer students are paying tuition. But the point is that the tuition is still being paid. So my first question goes to what did you mean by that statement?
Mr. Mackey.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Albright. What I meant by that statement, as far as our total tuition that's collected at an institutional level, is that there was basically less volume of students paying the tuition. So the overall amount of tuition being paid was decreasing at many institutions from a year-over-year basis.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mackey, so based upon MMB's own figures from 2019, median household income in Minnesota has remained relatively flat during the time period that you cite on page 6. Yet tuition rates at all institutions for higher education seem to be increasing, not in terms of the dollar value per se, but in terms of the percentage of their household income. It used to be 26%, and now in the recent survey in 15-16, it's up to 35%. And so my question to you is, in the context of that statement, if in fact tuition, to your point, has only grown, you know, by 1.5% flat, but personal income is basically stayed flat or whatever, why can't individuals afford to go to college?
Mr. Mackey.
I'm Chair Bernardi, Representative Albright. I think the cost of attending higher education, I think there's a couple other components that are significant consideration besides tuition. I think it's also the overall cost of attendance of other factors, housing, other things that play into that overall cost. The tuition is usually a portion of that cost. In some cases, like at our universities, it can be half or 60% of the total cost of attending the university. I think the other factor that we need to consider in evaluating that too is what the changes have been related to financial aid over that time period, and what the net cost of attending one of our colleges or universities is during that time period, and not just the increases in the gross in the tuition rate. So I think overall there has been more stress, and the income levels have definitely played a part in it. And Minnesota State has tried not only in trying to keep tuition affordable, but also there's been a lot of work done at our institutions of providing more scholarship resources. And then there's been more funding and with the state grant and Pell grants rising to help with that cost.
Representative Albright, do you have a follow-up?
I do. You know, in the context of retention or to completion of the career path itself, are you familiar with the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership?
Mr. Mackey.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Albright, yes, I am.
Madam Chair, my question is, one of the points in there is to suggest that, you know, there are significant and substantial barriers for the BIPOC community in terms of accomplishing their goal, whether it be a four-year degree or going back to school for an advancement of their own career path. And one of the factors that they talk about in there is the continuation of utilization of designed for shared responsibility in terms of the state, the family, and the individual. In your opinion, is that a model that should continue to be utilized in light of the changing demographics of our state?
Mr. Mackey.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Albright, Minnesota State doesn't have a specific position on that particular item. Related to that, with our biennial budget request and our system's focus on equity 2030, a significant component of our biennial budget request is to seek additional scholarship funds for access and opportunity for students to help address some of those barriers and to try to be able to target that flexible funding to our most needy students.
Representative Albright, do you have a follow-up?
Just one last question for Mr. Mackey. So in the context of what we've covered thus far, if tuition is flat and housing hasn't done much in terms of the cost, what would be your opinion in terms of the key contributor to these increases at our institutions in terms of the cost of a college education? If it's not tuition and it's not overhead administrative expense, I go back to my first question. What is contributing to the increase in the cost of a college education that we hear on a regular basis in this committee and in our communities, that people are saying, I can't afford to go back to college, it's too expensive? Can you answer that question for me? And I appreciate your answer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Mackey.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Albright, some of the cost factors that we address that have where we need revenue to cover those, mentioned that compensation is 70% of our budget, and we have reduced our FTE of faculty and staff as our enrollment has gone down. But however, we have seen increases in health insurance costs and with modest increases in compensation in order to be able to compete for the talent needed at our colleges and universities. We also have other costs related to technology and infrastructure that we need to continue to support to be competitive. And one example related to that is we are currently, Minnesota State is currently going through the replacement of an ERP system, NextGen, which many committee members may be familiar that we've asked for funding for in the past. And that project has a significant cost to it that will ultimately benefit our students. So all those types of variables are ones where we need to be able to have funding in order to support that, in order to meet what the expectations are of our students.
I don't see any further hands. Mr. Mackey, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. I'm going to shift gears now to provide just an update of our budget for fiscal year 21, and talk a little bit about we've touched upon some of these our main budget components, and it really I touched upon a couple of them. But enrollment is a very important component to all of our colleges and universities, and both recruiting new students and even more important, retaining current students and ensuring that they persist and complete what their goals were in coming to one of the Minnesota State colleges or universities. We also, our colleges and universities, as I mentioned, rely on tuition and fee revenues and state support. And Vice President Clues will kind of talk when I turn it over to her about how some of these components relate, but also related to our components, and I did address that a little bit in Representative Albright's questions, is we have wage and benefit costs and ongoing obligations that often we have to figure out how we support those. And as we have many different contract and labor agreements that the system is responsible for, some that are negotiated through MNB and some that Minnesota State negotiates with their faculty units, and then ongoing obligations. So as we think about our budgets, and going back to when I showed the breakdown of the 30 colleges and the 7 universities' reliance on tuition and appropriation, these are the major areas that our CFOs and our presidents think about as they balance as they do the best to allocate the resources they have to educating the students and providing services on their campus. So for this particular year, for fiscal year 2021, and we provide a budget, our budget's approved in June, and then we provide an update to our board in October, and we're providing another one in March, is again, as you can see, we rely heavily on the general fund. It's in the October number, it's $1.67 billion out of $2.1 billion of our revenue. You'll see there's the last line, there's the federal funding that was distributed last spring to colleges and universities into the equation. And then compensation is our primary expense, $1.35 billion, and then other operating, about $750 million. So we rely heavily on the tuition and the state appropriation, which is our general fund activity. Our revenue fund activity, again, is our residence halls and our student unions and some other amenities. And then we have a variety of other things I've mentioned in other funds. Our state appropriation, again, when our campuses built their budgets, and we have this line in here, program fund balance, because we have to have a balanced budget, is when we talk about having a structural deficit sometimes, this is the line item that we're referring to, is that our campuses were using $51 million in program and in fund balance to help cover the gap for a particular year where current revenues don't match current expenses, and to allow them time to make the necessary budget adjustments. Several of our colleges and universities are at any one point in time are going through budget adjustments to adjust for changes that they have in enrollment. And recently, in most cases, it's been downward trends in enrollments. But the same stands true for when enrollment is growing and programs and services need to ramp up. How we allocate our funding to our institutions, and there's a lot on this chart, but I'm going to start on the right side with the student side, and this is our tuition and fee rates being assessed to our students, the financial aid, family contributions, work income, and how that helps support a student's education. But the point I want to make with this portion of it is that 100% of our tuition and fees are kept at each one of our 30 colleges and 7 universities. So how enrollment is going at each college and university has a direct immediate impact on the budget of a college and universities. The side on the left, the allocation, the state appropriation, and that's the majority of explaining how we allocate our state appropriation that we want to share with you this afternoon, is that our Board of Trustees has an allocation framework that allocates just over $750 million on an annual basis of state appropriation. And it's broken down into a few different categories. Priority allocation, starting on the left, that includes board and legislative priority funding that's sent to all of our colleges and universities, or some depending on it. One of them is, for example, we have $9.8 million for access and opportunity that we've funded to campuses based on their split of Pell eligible students as well as first generation college students. And then that being a priority that we emphasize those services so resources follow that priority. Our colleges and universities spend much more than $9.8 million per year, but that's an example. Another one that falls in that category is we have funding for leveraged equipment that colleges and universities work with business and industry partners and leverage private funding to help support having the most state-of-the-art equipment available for their technical programs and other professional programs. That accounts for about 5% of our $750 million or so. Institutional allocations, I'll come back to that one. That is the vast majority. System office is 4% of our allocation, and that's been set by state statute at $33 million for the system office since fiscal year 2012. The next one on the right, what we call set-asides, makes up about 7% of our budget. And some of the examples we have there, I mentioned our enterprise, our ERP replacement, or that falls under there. The debt service that we set aside to pay for our geo bonding projects is in that category. We also set aside money to pay the Attorney General's office when we have, we need legal advice. We also have a system, library services, that's covered under there. So that makes up about 7% of our allocation. Going back now to the yellow box, the institutional allocations, that's where 84 to 85% of our funding is distributed directly to our colleges and universities through an internal allocation model. And Vice President Clues will walk you through spending a significant amount of time explaining that. It's a very mature, fairly complex model that tries to be transparent to our colleges and universities and also try to incent the right behaviors by our colleges and universities to receive state funding. So, just generally, before I turn it over to Vice President Clues, our colleges and universities receive a single allocation, a block grant of state appropriation as a result of the allocation framework. So Vice President Clues is going to explain the various components that go into it of how determining the amount of money that goes to each college and university. However, the funding goes to the college and university in a block grant, and colleges and universities presidents have the local discretion to prioritize those funds on their campuses. We allocate the funding. We have one allocation that goes to each of our 30 presidents. So while we have 30 colleges and 7 universities, for the Northeast Higher Ed District, for Dakota and Inver, for Anoka Technical College and Anoka Ramsey Community College, for Bemidji State University and Northwest Technical Community College, they receive one allocation, and then they allocate that amount locally between the individual colleges and universities. So we allocate one allocation to each one of our institutions based on the 30 presidents that we have, and they retain that authority to make the budget and spending decisions on behalf of their campuses. Again, revenue not going through this model stays at the campus level. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Vice President Clues to walk you through some of the mechanics of our allocation model, and as well give you some insight of how St. Cloud Technical and Community College manages utilizing this model and other budgetary practices that they have. So with your permission, Chair Bernardi, I'll turn it over to Vice President Clues.
Mr. Mackey, is this a natural place to pause, or is there information that's being built on that would be better to pause after Ms. Clues testifies? Mr. Mackey.
Chair Bernardi, I think it would I think it would be better if Vice President Kloos went into her presentation and might answer some questions that members might have, and then there'll be a pause there before turning over to talking about her individual institution.
Okay, so Ms. I didn't see any hands up, and so Ms. Kloos, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and committee members. I really appreciate the opportunity today to share how that allocation framework impacts St. Cloud Technical and Community College, and then how we use those funds within our own general fund operating budget. The next slide is going to share and display the component that Vice Chancellor Mackey was talking about regarding the allocation calculation and the percent share. That doesn't drive a dollar value, but it drives a percent share that is assigned to each institution, and then that determines the amount of the allocation given to each institution. What I appreciate about the model is that the allocation calculation does provide some stability from year to year, as the allocation is based on a percent share, and it has a two-year smoothing feature that provides some consistency, and yet it responds to institutional enrollment and individual institutional investment choices. And it also now has a component that recognizes student success, which is very important to us. So to demonstrate, if you see on the second to bottom row, St. Cloud Technical and Community College, and you follow that all the way along to the last column, the percent share of the fiscal year 21 allocation for St. Cloud Technical and Community College is 2.3%. When you look at the top, the very top row in the columns, you'll see that there's a base allocation, a percent share of fiscal year 20 allocation, and then 50% share of previous allocation. And so that's how we're arriving at the 2.3% when we get to the last column. Again, what's helpful in that is that with our tuition and fees, we know that that can fluctuate based on enrollment. So by having a more consistent model in that smoothing process, we know that our allocation that rolls through to the institutions, we have some consistency. So while we can plan on, there might be some fluctuation on that allocation side, we also know that we can count on having at least that 50% of what we had previously. So we have time to make the adjustments that are needed within the budget to account for any decreases that there might be in allocation or from tuition and enrollment. So if you go to the next slide, the allocation model was really developed with a lot of collaborative input. And in 2018, the board approved several changes to the framework for implementation, and it was implemented in 2018. These changes were made after a year-long collaborative review process, and it was led by the Technical Allocation Committee. The Technical Allocation Committee was made up of several college financial officers and college academic officers from various institutions. And I was actually part of that Technical Allocation Committee. What I really appreciated about the process that was developed by Minn State is that we were able to actually discuss changing components of the model, and then we ran it through the model to see what the impact was before it was ever implemented. That way we could see, were there unintended consequences that we really needed to reevaluate and take a step back. We also had board direction, and the changes were based on board principles, and they were intended to promote and support student success, make the framework more responsive to changing conditions, better align the cost of programs and services with resources, and increase transparency and simplicity. As Vice Chancellor Mackey said, this is a complex model driven by a set of algorithms, but there's been a lot of thought put into how this model works so that it is transparent, that institutions can refer back to this as a tool and recognize how changes that we make on investing in our programs might impact us on the allocation side, and what the framework, how that might drive additional resources or not, based on the decisions that we make. So we'll assess each of these components of the allocation model, and we'll talk more about particularly instruction and academic support in the next slide. But instruction and academic support is actually looking at the actual instruction and academic support expenditures for each institution at the level of instruction. So lower division, upper division, and graduate level. So it's comparing like programs within our system and driving the value of what is being spent in those programs while recognizing efficiencies within those programs. The student services and institutional support component, we are compared to national spending and similar classifications of institutions. And the model drives dollar values based on that national comparison. Now, if an institution within our system is higher cost than those national averages, then the institution doesn't receive that value. But if you're lower cost than the average, it recognizes and rewards those efficiencies within the allocation framework. Facilities are recognized within the model, especially if there's multiple campuses, recognizing that there are additional costs for that. Student success, this was really a key component that was added in 2018 that we're happy to see in here because it really does address third term persistence and completion rate and our student success ratio for our BIPOC students. We know there's an achievement gap. We know that we have to eliminate that achievement gap and that all of our students need to enjoy success. And so the piece of this component recognizes those initiatives that campuses put into place and rewards institutions that are making progress towards persistence and completion. And then there's a research and public service component. So this slide is the allocation model and how it recognizes cost differences in academic programs. And this is that instructional and academic support component that was on the previous slide. So this is an example of how this works in practice. And if you see on the left-hand column, it's called SIP code. That stands for the classification of instructional programs. It's a nationwide classification for higher education institutions. And we use that classification code within Minnesota State to compare ourselves against our sister institutions. What happens is that we look at the, and I'll use English language and literature as an example, the top row. We actually gather together any campus that has English language and literature, that classification code, the direct academic instructional costs based on the allocation. We take tuition out of it because we're driving the allocation that's coming through the system. So we take the direct instructional costs and compare that with all the institutions offering that academic programming. Again, this is broken out by lower division, upper division, and graduate program. So there's similar programming. And there is an average cost that's determined. Within that, there's a low band and a high band. So if an institution is in the average and they're delivering instruction per FYE at the average cost, the allocation framework recognizes that amount and drives that numerical value. If an institution is higher cost than the average or outside of the band and its instructional investments are more than the high band, the institution isn't recognized in the framework for those additional investments that institution is making. If an institution is more efficient and is offering that instruction below that band, that low band, then the allocation framework recognizes that institution at the average level and drives that numerical value. Now again, these are the numerical values, but in the end, it drives the percent share. So these aren't the actual dollars that come through the institution. What I appreciate about the instructional cost, though, is that it recognizes that different academic programs do have different costs to offer. So English language, there may be 32 students in our classrooms, but we don't have a lot of supply costs or equipment costs. When we get down to welding or ground transportation, those are equipment intensive and they're supply intensive. We are purchasing a lot of equipment. When I think of welding, we're looking at CNC machinery. These are not inexpensive, just to keep them running is expensive. And the allocation model recognizes those higher programming costs and drives those dollars through to the institutions. Registered nursing is another perfect example because that one is very labor intensive. Our accreditation standards require that we have lower faculty to staff ratios, especially when we get into clinical sites. And so you can see that the average programming for registered nursing is much higher than it is for English language and literature. And so the allocation framework provides the recognition for those various academic programming costs and drives it to the institution for use. And again, at the institutional level, we decide where we allocate those resources, but the allocation framework provides us the opportunity to do that. Are there any questions regarding the allocation framework, the components, and how the model works for allocating state resources?
Members, are there any questions? I do not see any hands up at this point. Ms. Clues, do you have a further presentation?
I do, thank you. Excuse me. what I want to walk through next is, our St. Clair Technical and Community College's general fund revenue sources. So this is just to demonstrate the allocation that flows through to St. Clair Technical and Community College is 46% of our funding for fiscal year 20. This is just the general fund. So this is where all of our instructional costs land and our revenue lands. So 49% of our revenue for fiscal year 20 was tuition, and 46% of our resources were from the state allocation. What's interesting is that in fiscal year 21, I expect that that will flip. With COVID, we did see an 8.5% enrollment decline for fiscal year 21. And I anticipate that our state funding will make up 46% of our resources for this current year, and tuition will really land at that 46%. And so that is where that tuition can fluctuate. And it's nice to have that smoothing component of the allocation framework. When that translates over to the expense side, for fiscal year 20, our academic and instructional programming made up 60% of our expenses, and our student services made up 12%. So if you think back to Vice Chancellor Mackey's presentation, we really are right in that mix at 72% for direct student academic programming and student support. Institutional support made up about 10% of our budget for fiscal year 20, facilities plant operations 8%, repair and replacement, every year we make a commitment to invest in our capital assets. We always appreciate higher education asset preservation dollars, because when we have to do something major like replace a plant boiler system, that is challenging to carve out of our operational dollars. But we do take care of our facilities, and that is a commitment that we make every year. And then technology was about 5% of our overall expense budget. What's interesting is that in fiscal year 20, we did make some reallocations. Typically, we do invest more than 72% in student support and academic support. But right now, about 30% of our student population is made up of our BIPOC students, our Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And we recognize that there is an achievement gap, and we want to address that. And so in working with our students, there were some clear institutional and student services needs that we needed to invest in. So this last year, we did do some reallocations. We invested in a licensed mental health professional that is here on campus. This was critically important with COVID. We made investments in food insecurity. We made investments in additional advising and accommodation support. And we also invested in institutional research on the institutional side, because we really want to assess, are these investments making a difference, or what else can we do to eliminate that achievement gap? We also hired a vice president of cultural fluency, equity, and inclusion. And we've been investing dollars in anti-racism training for our students, our faculty, our staff, and our foundation board. With the tragic events over this last year, we recognized that there were a lot of questions, and there were a lot of students and employees that needed support. And so we've been holding living room conversations, doing trainings, and really reallocating resources to make sure that we are meeting some of those needs. Our next step is to assess and to say, are we meeting all the needs that we can, or are there further steps to be taken? And I'm pretty certain there are further steps to be taken and other resources that are needed. So our process, as we are going through all of this, and as we are looking at fiscal year 21, we knew that we were likely going to see a decline in enrollment as a result of COVID. We also knew what our appropriation was going to be. So we had a series of conversations with our union leadership, with our faculty shared governance, with our students, and ultimately developed a list of priorities and then sustainability adjustments to be able to look at an approach for fiscal year 21 and beyond. And we had some overarching financial management philosophies that we shared with the groups. The first being that money is a tool. It's a means to achieving the end, to fulfilling our mission. And we don't want our budget to drive our strategic priorities, but rather we need to align our budget to our strategic priorities. We have to spend with an expectation of clear results. And we are focused right now on equity and inclusion and the achievement gap. We need to look at long-term stability. We have to be future-oriented, and we have to think about the perpetual financial viability of the college. So it's tempting to say, well, this is a one-time thing. With COVID, things will get better. And we are taking the approach of what might this look like long-term? How is this going to change higher education, and how do we think differently about what the future might look like? Pay-as-you-go, we are trying to set funding aside for those key priorities that we might be looking at in the future. And I'll give an example. We have been placing funds aside for a multicultural center for some time, and it's been talked about for some time. And this year is the year that we're going to do it. And so we have a group right now that's looking at space, and we'll be using campus resources to create a multicultural center and really working towards making all of our students feel welcome and included. We need to save with the plan and purpose and maintain reserves so that we have flexibility for future opportunities and challenges. If someone would have told us when we were building fiscal year 20 budget that we'd be facing COVID, that wasn't on our radar. We have to look at revenues that they exceed expenses, or at minimum, they have to balance it. We're trying to balance that budget, although we know that there are unforeseen events, and there are sometimes when we have to use reserves. And then we want to plan a budget for unforeseen emergencies and contingencies. And Vice Chancellor Mackey mentioned NextGen, and it's completely what we had been talking about. We were hoping that we would receive funding for NextGen, but we're concerned that if we were not able to receive all of the funding, we had to have resources available not only for the implementation, but the human resources. We realize this is going to take some significant investments on our campus in training and people to be able to implement NextGen, and that in the long run, this investment is going to pay off for efficiencies and better outcomes for our students. And so we have been able to put some funds aside for NextGen and are wrapping that into our budget planning process. Now, there's other things that we talked about that we would not do, guiding principles for our sustainability adjustments. Our actions wouldn't put our strategic initiatives put in place to support student completion. We would not look at reducing those. We wouldn't do things that would jeopardize future enrollment or put quality improvement at risk. Our actions cannot cause direct reductions in primary student services. Those areas where mental health, we're not going to reduce that. We know it's too critical of a need. We cannot take actions that increase the risk to safety and security. That's paramount, especially with COVID, and that our actions have to take a balanced approach. We can't expect that one department absorbs any adjustments that we make, but really we have to think strategically and be mindful of our planning and how it impacts our college. That's an overall view and approach that we take to managing our state resources and our tuition and fees. We appreciate your support. We are always mindful of how we're using our state taxpayer dollars and our student tuition and fees to the best possible manner to ensure that our students are successful, and we do appreciate your support. With that, I will turn it back over to Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Chair Byrne.
Mr. Mackey, we do have questions. Go ahead.
Oh, Chair Bernardi, thank you. That concludes our presentation. So we appreciate the opportunity, and we'll stand for additional questions.
Thank you. We have a number of questions. We are starting with Representative Sandell, and then we have Representative Erickson on deck. I believe that is based on what I'm looking at on my picture. Oh, excuse me, it's Representative O'Neill on deck. I apologize. Go ahead, Representative Sandell.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And Ms. Kluse, thanks very much. The presentation is really interesting, but I hope my questions don't sound awfully superficial, but I'm interested in the costs of instruction, and the cost of instruction, for example, with the ground transportation or nursing were much higher than those of political science and English. Does that mean that the student with a four-year degree in nursing or a two- or four-year degree, I guess, in some of the technologies like welding are going to be paying higher tuitions than students studying psychology or the liberal arts?
Who would like to take that question? Mr. Mackey.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Sandell. We do have, in some cases, have differential tuition rates to help cover extraordinary costs for some programs. And that is the case at some of our colleges and universities for some of the examples that you gave, where it might be $20 more a credit or $25 more a credit or something along those lines for courses in ground transportation or welding. The base tuition rate per student for undergraduates is the same irregardless of the programs that they're involved in. For example, the differential one for welding may be to help offset the cost of supplies or other things related to that. The difference in the cost per student, it varies for a lot of different reasons. Some of it has to do just with the nature of the courses. So the top three there are more general education, liberal arts courses. For example, at a university, this may be a course where there's 50 students in the class and there's an instructor, whereas a registered nursing program has has ratios that are dictated for clinicals by the accrediting body in order to do that, so that the faculty student ratios could be 10-1 versus 40-1. And then just by that nature, that there's a cost differentiation there. So each of our institutions handles this a little bit differently, but it is fair to say that in many cases, there is a slightly higher tuition rate at some of the higher cost technical programs than there are for the liberal arts, but that the base tuition rate is the same across the board.
Thanks very much. I certainly understand why those costs might be different.
Representative Sandell.
Pardon me, I'm sorry, Chair Bernardi. I understand why the cost of that instruction may be different. It seems to me that some being twice as expensive or more than twice as expensive might result in higher tuition. The other question I have is that we've heard that some students who may not be very well prepared for courses in perhaps English or in math need a developmental course. Is the cost of that developmental or supplemental instruction reflected in these in the costs that are here on the screen?
Mr. Mackey.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Sandel. They are represented within our allocation model. What we have on the screen is a sample of six different areas, and none of these six areas have a developmental component, but they are factored into the into our allocation model under their own SIP codes.
Chair Bernardi, thanks very much. I certainly appreciate the attention and detail. Thanks.
Representative O'Neill, and then we have Representative Erickson on deck, and then Representative Daniels. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So my question was actually raised when Chair Bernardi and I were in a faculty town hall, and the faculty raised the question about the cuts to the counselors, so the mental health counselors that are at some of the universities. Well, some of them don't have them anymore because of the cuts. And you had mentioned that at St. Cloud, you actually did a shift of allocation to help pay for some mental health counselors. And I'm wondering, is that something that you're considering doing system-wide, particularly in the pandemic and the stresses and everything that we've all been through in the past year? I'm wondering if that is a system-wide consideration that you have had.
And Ms. Clues, I'm going to have you answer that. I believe that's the question Representative O'Neill is directing it to. And could somebody turn off of the PowerPoint at this point? Then we will be able to see each other easier as we, there we go. Thank you. Representative O'Neill, the question was for Ms. Clues, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that clarification. It's really whoever can answer the question. I'm not sure if she can or if Mr. Mackey can, but it's more of taking the example that she gave in St. Cloud and wondering if that's a consideration that they're having for statewide, because I know certainly the faculty are very interested in the return of the counselors because the students are quite stressed because of the pandemic and all of that. So I'm just wondering if that's a consideration.
Mr. Mackey or Ms. Clues, who would like to take that one?
I will, Chair Bernardi. Chair Bernardi, Representative O'Neill, it certainly is a consideration, and the priority of additional support for mental health services is reflective in our biennial budget request, in that it's a priority. Each of our colleges and universities, how they staff that service, it does vary by college and university. And you heard an example specifically from Vice President Clues for St. Cloud Technical and Community College. Some of our universities have psychologist positions on their campuses. Others may partner with other agencies. So we have a diverse way of how presidents provide that additional service, but it's certainly a priority for Minnesota State, which is reflected in our biennial budget request.
Representative O'Neill,
thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick thank you, Madam Chair. So that's a little different than what the faculty were saying. Some are saying that they haven't had a counselor on site for years. And so I would just encourage you to really shift, you know, you did that for St. Cloud Technical College, and I encourage you to do it across the system because we certainly have the students that are quite stressed and having a really hard time navigating doing distant learning and everything else with the pandemic. So I would really encourage you to really focus on that so that we've got balanced students that can handle the stresses of what we're all going through, including getting an education. So I know that you had said that outside institutions are looked to, but they're saying that they're not available. There's not time slots. So there's a disconnect, and I'm just encouraging you to take a look at that disconnect. Thank you.
Representative Erickson, and then Representative Daniels are on deck. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Vice President Clues. You mentioned the achievement gap and that there's the need to close the achievement gap. So I'm wondering, to what extent do you have conversations or discussions with the K-12 system? I used to serve on the P-20 partnership and hope to do so again, about the fact that we have in law career and college readiness, And the chancellor and the commissioner have allegedly set the benchmark for admission to college based on, you know, what the student is achieving as a trajectory for college success. So I'm just wondering, what is that costing your system? And to what extent are you having those discussions so that the onus is placed back on K-12 where it should be, so that these students are not entering college? And as we heard in discussions a couple weeks ago, having to take remedial courses, they have to pay for them, they don't get credit for them. And I'm not sure that, you know, higher ed is even using the law to follow what's supposed to happen at the college level. You know, do they have an ACT or an SAT score, or an MCA score, for example, that might be acceptable so they don't have to take remediation? But this is an issue in K-12, and now it sounds like it's even an issue in higher ed. So would you comment on that, please?
Ms. Clues.
Chair Bernardi and
Vice President Clues.
Right. Okay.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Erickson, thank you for that question. It is really a critical issue, and we have been having conversations with our high schools in the area, particularly 742. We've actually asked one of the 742, the equity and inclusion individual, is on our foundation board and has been included in some of our anti-racism training. He's offered a lot of insights. But we're having the discussions about how do we get 742 involved? How do we work together? And what opportunities are there to address some of these concerns, even pre-high school, at the younger ages? And we're talking about what does that look like to introduce them to thoughts of college, to career exploration, versus whether that might be summer camps, whatever that might be. And then to get industry involved. So some of our discussions are working with our local workforce center, Career Solutions, in their Career One program. They partner with CentraCare Health, and they come on our campus. They do a summer program. They do remedial reading and math, and they do it on our college campus. And then we're providing workforce exploration opportunities for them, particularly in the manufacturing area, OSHA training, and CNA. Some of the students have the opportunity to earn some college credits while they're here, which is in the CNA and the OSHA training, but it's a collaborative partnership between industry, Career Solutions, and District 742 and some of our other high schools. So those discussions are ongoing, but we have had more recent discussions about how do we do more. I don't think it's enough, and so it's what do we do that's more, and how do we accelerate that because we recognize that need?
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. And thank you, Vice President Clues, for that response. Previously, when I served on the P20 partnership, I was disappointed that both the chancellor and the president of the University of Minnesota didn't take seriously the concerns that I would bring in regard to, you know, please don't admit these students if the K-12 system isn't doing its job. And, you know, years and years ago, we tried to impose a penalty on the K-12 system so that if students did get forced into taking remedial courses, it was billed back to the districts, but that didn't survive for very long. So that's over and done with. But I do want both the chancellor and the president of the university to understand that we have this gap, and the gap doesn't stop upon graduation if the child, the student, wants to matriculate into a college program. And we have to take care of that because that is costing, and it's also costing a lot of time for those students who are eager to become college students and to succeed. So, you know, I hope that the discussions will continue, and thank you for talking to 742 because that's very important in your area. And I will do likewise from my perspective as the ranking member on education policy here in the House. But we need to get that under control. And I'm afraid our achievement gap is going to grow even more now during the absence from the classroom, as is happening during the pandemic. So we really have to focus on helping those students overcome some of what they've missed, and you know, do diligence to them, because we owe that to them. Thank you.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question is directed to Mr. Mackey. My memory isn't as good as it used to be, but I think about 5 or 6 years ago, there was a discussion going around with the main offices for the state, Minnesota State, on 7th Street in St. Paul, that for a money-saving, cost-saving solution, they might actually move offices into one of the state colleges themselves. And I remember a little bit of the conversation that didn't go over real well for the state college. They didn't really want to do that. But I wonder if with this COVID thing, we've got personal families that are tightening their belts. We've got government that's trying to tighten their belt. We've got businesses trying to tighten their belt. If this may be issue or possibility might come back on the conversation tables. I just wonder if there's been any talk about that for a money saving issue that might include doing away with the main offices on 7th Street. So if, Mr. Mackey, if you're the one the person asked, that'd be wonderful.
Mr. Mackey.
I'm Chair Bernardi, I'm Representative Daniels. I would have to follow up and get more information on the analysis that was done in the recent past related to that. Currently, there's no discussions of leaving Wells Fargo Place. However, there definitely is discussion about renewing when the time comes to renew our lease, which is very soon, to reevaluate all the needs related to that, especially in light of how we've operated during the pandemic and what that might look like. So we are looking at ways to and hope to reduce that fixed cost in the very, very near future. I'll have to follow up with more information on that analysis. I wasn't in this position at that time, so I don't have it handy in my memory.
Representative Daniels, do you have a follow-up?
Just a word response. I appreciate that. If you want to do that with me offline when you find out, it just might be another avenue that we can help the state colleges trim their budget a little bit without hurting the student.
Members, I see no further hands. If we have 8 minutes, if anybody else wants to ask a quick question, we can split it up between the question and answer of whoever raises their hands. Otherwise, I'll take a moment here. We can wrap up, but I just wanted to, as we wait to see if anyone has hands, I want to thank the Vice Chancellor of Finance and Facilities, Bill Mackey, and the Vice President of Administration at St. Cloud Technical and Community College, Lori Klus, for your presentation today. And I don't see any further hands. Members, thank you, and those listening, for being here today. Tomorrow, I just wanted to give you a note. We will have the Office of Higher Education to go over the governor's budget. With that, the meeting is adjourned.